Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be shining the spotlight on one of the founders of the Church in Rome, 2,000 years after his birth. On the Pope, whose pontificate happened to coincide with the German occupation of Rome. And finally on an admiral who paid the price for his inquisitive nature at the time of the eruption of Vesuvius. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Let's begin by telling the story of Saul, or Paul, to mark the inauguration of a year specially dedicated to this saint who was born 2,000 years ago. So the microphone goes to our scripture scholar, Mark Coleridge, Archbishop of Australia's capital city, Canberra.
Saul was his Semitic name. Paul was the Roman name that he had from day one. He would have used Paul when he went to school or out into the marketplace. Saul would have been the name used at home. Now, we are dealing with one of the most vivid and overwhelming characters of the New Testament. He leaps off the page at you, like Jeremiah in the Old Testament. And this is amazing in an ancient world that didn't value personality and individuality as we do. Well, this is personality with a capital P. Who was he? He was a diaspora Jew of wealthy background. How do we know he was from a wealthy background? Two reasons. One, he was highly educated, and education tends to be always the privilege of the better off. And we also know that his parents were Roman citizens. Well, the only way that diaspora Jews could become Roman citizens was to pay a lot of money. So Paul was not one of your urban poor. He was from an urban, well-off background, and born into a city that was renowned as a cultural and academic centre. At an early age, he went to Jerusalem to pursue his Pharisaic, his religious studies, probably lived with relatives in Jerusalem. He becomes a well-known and respected figure as he grows older, and eventually he tells us he persecuted the Christians, so zealous was he for the faith of his ancestors. Then comes the fateful moment on the road to Damascus. What that moment was is hard to say, and Paul will spend the rest of his life unpacking the answer to the question, what does it mean, this overwhelming encounter with Jesus who came at him like a tidal wave? So overwhelming is the experience of encounter with Jesus, the one whom he had persecuted, that he goes off into the desert for 2 years or thereabouts. He calls it Arabia, but it's the desert area south of Damascus in modern-day Jordan. What was he doing? He doesn't tell us. But we can guess that he was simply grappling with the question, what does this mean, this experience of encounter? And the rest of his life will give his answer to that question. We then know for a fact that he went to Jerusalem for 2 weeks, he says, to exchange information with Peter. From Peter he needed to hear about Jesus because Paul had never met Jesus face to face. Peter also needed to hear from Paul, because there were all kinds of stories circulating about Paul. There always were. So Paul had to say, now listen to me, not them. So 2 weeks in Jerusalem, and then they agree that he should go home to Tarsus, strategic withdrawal for the time being. But in fact, he's back in Tarsus, it seems, for about 7 years. And it's Barnabas, whom we met last time, who brings Paul back onto the stage to the point where Paul becomes a member of that first ever missionary team, but not the leader. Then there's the big split with Barnabas and with Peter, it must be said, the brawl in Antioch over that issue of how Jewish and Gentile Christians should relate to each other. At this point, Paul has to make a big decision. Does he just go home, say it's all a bad joke, or what? He decides, in fact, not to go home, but to set up his own independent missionary team. And at this point, you can hear them howling in the background. Sore loser, megalomaniac, empire builder, false apostle, and these were the cries that would dog Paul throughout his apostolic career. The independent mission will take him into Europe because Paul regards himself as called to go where no one else has gone. So he crosses the Hellespont from Asia into Europe, and there he begins a life of constant journeying, ceaseless travelling, but also ceaseless suffering. In fact, Paul's apostolic career is so much a story of suffering that you've got to ask, why didn't he at some point just pack up and go home, give it all up? The answer is strange and wonderful. And it's that Paul comes to see that the very thing that should destroy him, like persecution, like imprisonment, are the things that are strangely giving his mission power, giving life to him as an apostle. So he sees that his whole ministry and career are like the death of Jesus. It should have been the end, but it was the beginning. It should have destroyed Jesus, but it had the opposite effect. So Paul comes to see that the wound becomes a fountain. And that's the key to understanding him and why he didn't go home. All of his journeying leads to his beheading down in what's called Tre Fontane, here in Rome. And then he is taken by his disciples, the Christians of Rome, and buried not too far away. And once again, as with Peter, they put over his grave a huge and magnificent basilica, San Paolo fuori le mura, which simply spells out the magnificence of the witness that Paul gave, not only in life, but more particularly in death. What we see too is that in his death he finds his way to Peter, and that's why they're so often represented together. Here in Rome you will never see Peter without Paul, and you'll never see Paul without Peter, because in their martyrdom, in this one city, they find their way to each other completely, because they find their way completely to Jesus. So, you and I presume that you, like myself, were not born Jewish. Insofar as that is true, we are all, in a very strict sense, sons and daughters of St. Paul, sons and daughters of the great Gentile mission, which in the face of all opposition, he pursued through life and beyond death.
Well, thanks there, as always, to Scripture scholar Bishop Mark Coleridge, Archbishop of Canberra in Australia. And now, as we leave behind us the story of Paul, who's the patron saint of Rome, together with St. Peter, it's time to focus on the Pope, whose pontificate, as I mentioned a moment ago, coincided with the German occupation of Rome. So stay tuned as I bring you some exclusive sound from our very own archives, including the witness of some of those who lived through those dramatic days. So do get ready to listen to the voice of the Pope of that era, Pius XII. That is the actual sound of the air raid on Rome on July the 19th, 1943.
L'umanità lo deve alle molte migliaia di non combattenti, donne, bambini, infermi e vecchi, a cui la guerra aerea, il cui orrore.
And Pope Pius XII continued to decry the atrocities of a war that had been raging for over 4 years.
Ha tolto vita, beni, salute, case, luoghi di carità e di preghiera.
When Rome was bombed, the Pope, while the bombing was still going on, ordered his car and went right away to the place, exposing himself to real danger because the bombing was still going on. He tried to speak to the people to console them. He knelt down, his cassock was covered with blood.
Jesuit Father Peter Gumpel recalled how the Pope went out to be among his fellow Romans on that dramatic day.
And the thing was particularly tragic in this sense, that he had done everything possible to persuade the Allies not to bomb Rome, but the Allies did not recognize Rome to be an open city.
The day that the Allies bombed, because we kept on saying they'll never bomb Rome, they'll never touch Rome, the Pope had asked for an open city. But in fact, that day came when they did bomb, and that's down San Lorenzo. They continued to bomb that station, but they hit the basilica.
Ursuline's sister, and Kathleen England, was in Rome during that ugly, unexpected chapter in the city's history.
Transport, whatever. to do something with another sister, and we saw all the crowds coming out, Regina, Margherita, carrying what they could, walking up from their whole place had been bombed. So we went to San Lorenzo, and San Lorenzo was just one heap of ruins, except for the sanctuary. And we sat on the stone bench at the top part of the sanctuary, which is still, you can see it. And we ate a crust of bread and looked down on these ruins. When I have been there sometimes now and heard tourists talking, I've said, you never knew what it was.
Above all, the Pope was tried to avoid Rome being involved in the war action. And then, of course, under the German occupation, which lasted 9 months, an incredible period in history, which things happened that are... you can't imagine how it was that they were so possible. That was just so anomalous the situation was in Rome. And, of course, the police...
Jesuit Father Robert Graham, foremost historian on the Vatican in World War II, lived through the German occupation of the city.
The resistant people were being arrested, and famous Kappler was an SS police chief in Rome. And then, of course, on the 16th of October, the Jews were... There was a special task force of German anti-Semites came down here, and in one night they scooped up with 1,000 Jews, as we know, and the Pope made his protest, but he didn't. I, as an American, I would like to have gone down to the ghetto, you know, and like Attila, you know, against Attila, the famous Pope in the early days. But he did protest. And most important, among others, was his work of Padre Pancrazio Pfeiffer, who was the right-hand man of the Pope for this sort of thing. He was a German. He had contacts with the Germans. And the historical record shows that Pancrazio was intervening himself in the name of the Pope with the Germans to lay off, take it off, save Rome. So it was a dramatic situation from September 1943 until June 1944. Nobody knew what the next day would bring.
Someone shot a German, and they took hostages. They took every other house, took somebody, totally innocent, and there were about 300 of them, and they took them to the Argentina, and they killed the whole lot of them. And this was a terrible moment. We got a sort of bush telephone, which told us, people were telling each other what was happening, but that was a revenge, I suppose a wartime revenge, on something that had been done to the enemy.
When the roundup of the Jews in Rome started, that morning I was sitting off in my office in Palazzo San Callisto and heard this, that the army trucks, the German trucks, ran out, and there at the back, near Villa Cisterna, they were going into a building, and these people were being brought out. And then later I found out that they were Jews. And we thought immediately that they were being taken to a labour camp.
Monsignor Carol Abbing was encouraged by Pius XII to organise humanitarian relief on the battlefront south of Rome.
And perhaps to mass for the first time in months. And many of them were rounded up afterwards and taken off to labour camps, or digging ditches or other things, or fortifications, you see. So it was all very... today, we must have known by... And, of course, the great thing was, as many protests came during that time, that the Holy Father was speaking out too much. So he's, for him, he's in the Vatican there, he's not being touched. But we have to face, you see. And sometimes when some of the bishops had been very, very explicit of the northern countries, there was an immediate reaction, an accentuation of roundups of people hostile to the Jews and others, you see, as an immediate result. And so they're saying, why doesn't he keep his mouth shut? So it was very difficult for the person in the street.
Pius XII couldn't do more than what he did, and that I'm absolutely sure, because every convent in Rome had an enormous piece of paper outside the convent to say that it belonged to the Vatican, and therefore the Germans weren't allowed to go in.
Josette Brucoleri was a student in Rome during the German occupation.
A lot of were Jews, and also a lot of Italians who had been real anti-fascists were being sought for by the Germans to be sent to be tortured or sent to the German concentration camps.
The reports about concentration camps and what happened in these concentration camps had to be taken with an enormous amount of prudence, because there was always the danger that this was propaganda issued by the Allies. This had happened in the First World War, in which especially the press headed by the later Lord Beaverbrook accused German soldiers of having cut off the hands of children, when after the war in Belgium investigations were made, it turned out to be absolutely untrue. And in the British Parliament itself, it was later recognized that this had been a propaganda stunt. And the same thing happened in the Second World War. Many rumors were spread deliberately, and it was very difficult to ascertain. And it would have been dangerous for the Pope to come out with concrete statements unless they could be proved by ironclad documents. Unless you have lived under a very tight dictatorship, a highly organized political dictatorship, unless you have done that, it is very difficult to imagine the situation in which people were living.
I mean, we wouldn't even speak in the family about things we knew about we knew by chance where somebody was hidden. There were the people who were on the side of the SS and who would do anything to say where somebody was hiding. And then there were the other crowd, whom, like me, and who knew things, but I never spoke to anybody.
You were in Palazzo Doria when the Germans came to take away the Prince Doria, no?
Yes, well, that was a terrible evening, frightful evening. The Germans surrounded the palace and broke the doors, but Prince Doria hid in the archives.
Why did they want to arrest Prince Doria?
He was a well-known anti-fascist. He'd always been anti-fascist. A lot of people were anti-fascists, but they pretended they weren't, because it was also a question of survival.
The Germans came to look for us. So we went into hiding.
How long were you in hiding for?
The 9 months of the German occupation, September 43 to June 44.
Princess Doria Pompili remembered that dramatic evening and the subsequent drama of going into hiding together with her mother. She also recalled how Monsignor O'Flaherty, a family friend who ran a rescue operation inside Vatican City for refugees, scolded her for taking too many risks.
And very fond of. In fact, when we were in hiding, he came to see us one day, knowing there was a South African prisoner hiding with the same family, and said, I know what you... There were two, a mother and daughter we were hiding with, and my mother and I were there, and he said, I know what you girls are up to. We're going to move him. It's too dangerous. And he did get moved, in fact, because if you were caught with an Allied prisoner, you were shot, of course.
Mother used to take the letters out of the boxes of the Red Cross. She worked there. Then she brought them home. And then I, in my school uniform, at 18, with plaits and a blackberry on my head, coat that was miles too small for me. I had nothing else to wear anyway. I used to go into the Vatican and take them to Monsignor O'Flaherty.
You had the famous rescue operation of Monsignor O'Flaherty. In union with the British, you must realize the British had quite a developed program of escapes and evasions, namely the whole system, not merely in Rome, but all through the occupied areas. There were the British had a network of relief for their own prisoners of war. The highways of Italy were filled with escaped British prisoners of war. Where do they go? The Germans picked them up and shipped them to Germany. In many cases, others managed to escape the German police, and a lot of them came into Rome. They thought that was safe there, and in a certain sense it was.
The Pope sheltered a lot of people in the Vatican and in Castel Gandolfo. And he organized a whole, everything was organized in collaboration with the International Red Cross, I think. And there's no doubt that he was in a position where it was touch and go. He was a very great pope. He did an enormous amount in a very difficult situation.
Nobody knew what the next day would bring, but the Pope was there always, and his hand hung over the city like a good angel.
I hope you enjoyed this exclusive sound from our very own Vatican Radio archives, focusing on the figure of Pope Pius XII, who, for the record, was elected as successor of Peter on the 2nd of March 1939 and died on the 9th of October 1958. But now hold tight, as on a different note, we move on to join our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. Lot about the Plinys, the elder and the younger, right?
Well, a lot. I mean,
well, by most
I mean, they're two very good and favored and beloved authors, Latin authors.
Shall we begin with the elder Pliny? He was on a boat, no? When Vesuvius?
Well, actually, he was the admiral of the fleet.
He was the admiral of the fleet?
Because the headquarters of the Roman fleet, this is Augustus's time, was in Pozzuoli, Capo Miseno, as they call it. If you have an idea of the Bay of Naples, way on the west end, it comes around.
So very close to the volcano, Vesuvius.
Well, it's the other side of the Bay of Naples. And so that's where they had their admiral's ship and the whole fleet, and he was the admiral of the fleet.
How would you say that? Pliny the Elder was in command of the Roman
no,
fleet?
No, Navarcus praerat classi Romanae. Praerat, he was in charge of. Navarcus as an admiral, that's our word
prayer.
Now. Navarcus praerat classi Romanae.
Mm.
And that's why when all that stuff with the volcano, he commanded the biggest ship they had, four reams, you know, quadriremus, you know, four ranks of oars.
Mm.
It's a massive thing, and that was his admiral's ship. And he got on it, and he said, go right across and head into the volcano.
Mm.
And people said, well, you're crazy. Everyone's running away. Everyone's running to the west, and you're going over there. Well, he had a problem because the seabed was coming up because of, you know, earthquakes and all that stuff. And his ship got caught, but then later on he was able to get on land. But that's what he was doing at that time, being a natural historian, you see.
Mm, yeah, he wrote this.
And he wrote, I don't know, 25, 27 books or something of natural history about everything.
He wrote this Naturalis.
Historia Naturalis, which is extremely interesting. About animals and plants and everything.
At any rate, getting back to the Latin, how would you call a ship in Latin?
Well, navis.
Navis. Didn't have a different name according to the type of ship.
Well, then, certainly, navis longa was a warship. They call it a long ship, a navis longa. Navis mercatoria, or merchant ship. And then, of course, quadriremus was four things, triremes. Triremes was three banks of oars and B. Ramis, they had all these different things, different kinds of boats.
I wonder what kind of a sound it made.
What?
The quadri Ramis.
You can imagine the power there, though. And the engineering that went into all that stuff. And well, he jumped on his admiral's ship and wanted to go over to the volcano.
His nephew
stayed at home, Capo Miseno, with his mother, who was Plinius's sister, you see.
There was a description of, you know, the eruption of the volcano, no?
Actually, his nephew there gave two of them.
Concording or discording?
Well, no, concording, there was no problem. To the famous historian Tacitus.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tacitus never got that far in his histories, but he was going to put this in. And Pliny said, I was there, and he describes it. Then Tacitus came back and said, but could you add a few more details? And he wrote a second letter about Vesuvius.
And how did he describe it?
Oh, it's incredible. We read these things in class, every single thing. The ashes coming down and people...
How do you say all that in Latin?
Cineres decide bante templo. They had pillows on their heads.
Tied with napkins. How do you say...
Incidencia, contra incidencia. They put pillows against the things that were falling from the heavens. They had pillows. These rocks were falling from the heavens.
How would you say Pliny and his friend... tied pillows on their heads with napkins and sallied forth in the dark.
Ad ligabant capitibus, pulvinos. Pulvinos, pillows. Ad ligabant capitibus. Et ita excedebant. And then we went out ad ligatis pulvinis, with pillows having been tied on their heads.
Well, I mean, it sounds very funny, but actually...
It wasn't funny, it was tragic.
In fact, Pliny died, didn't he?
The old man, yes.
Pliny the Elder died.
Yeah, well, they found him the next day, and they said, sleeping on the road, they said, like a man who just lay down to take a nap. He must have been asphyxiated. It wasn't any burnt or anything like that, but they said he was found sleeping quietly on the side of the road. So he got out of the ship to take notes.
For his book?
For his natural histories, book, you see. Yeah.
So how do you say all that in Latin? Just tell me.
Hic omnia facilime dici possunt. Ergo excessit de navi ut eventum describeret, that he might describe the event. Et ibi captus est fortasse vaporibus, he was taken over by vapors, et decidit et mortuus est. Strangulatus, oppressus, because he was kind of heavy, he was fat,
Obesus,
and he had like asthma, so he couldn't breathe well.
Because there was a strong smell of sulfur, no?
So he shouldn't have gone there because he couldn't breathe well to begin with.
And they found him sleeping like a top.
Quiet. I mean, no pain or anything. He just kind of maybe fainted and.
How'd you say sleeping like a top?
Like a top. Dormieva nejo uti musculus.
Well, he certainly put his head in the teeth of the wind, no? Yeah, that's an expression that he might have used, no? Because the epistles of Horace say, to strive with all the tempest in my teeth.
In contrarium ventum, into the contrary wind, you'd say.
Warm thanks, as always, to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, and he's currently working at the Vatican's Secretariat of State as the Pope's own Latinist. He'll be back again at this same time next week. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Or should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.